My name is Michael McCusker. Memorial Day and Labor Day, which used to have significance, really only act as bookends anymore towards the summer tourist season. One begins it, the other ends it. But even in the midst of our gaiety and drinking and all that sort of stuff, we have young people and not so young people killing and dying in various places around the world. I'd like to read a couple of things I've written, which you're about to hear, is my opinion and perhaps my opinion only in the entire cosmos. I'd like to begin with a quote from Dalton Trumbo. If anybody remembers, he wrote that great book, Johnny Got His Gun, and also was on the blacklist until Kirk Douglas, in a few movies, had Dalton, because he produced them, had Dalton Trumbo put his name on his scripts, and that broke the blacklist of the from the McCarthy era, at least the Hollywood 10 blacklist. Dalton Trumbo. If the dead mean nothing to us, except on Memorial Day weekend when the National Freeway is clotted with surfers, swimmers, skiers, picnickers, campers, hunters, fishers, footballers, beer busters, what of our wounded? Does anyone know where they are, how they feel, how many arms, legs, ears, noses, mouths, faces, penises they've lost? How many are deaf and dumb or blind or all three? How many are single or double or triple or quadruple amputees? How many will hang on as desebrated vegetables, quietly breathing their lives away in small, dark, secret rooms? And that was Dalton Trumbo. I'd like to begin with, do dead soldiers have souls? And again, this is something I wrote. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are as much about democracy as they are about oil and empire, simply because the soldiers who are fighting the wars anxiously wish to believe they are, however manipulated and deceived they are into that belief. The same can be said about any war. The U.S. Civil War was about slavery because that was the essential reason the soldiers on both sides fought it for and against. World War I was to put an end to war because the soldiers who endured the worst hell on earth, which they created for themselves, slaughtered each other by the millions for that fervent hope, which might have been a not-so-subjective basis for the fierce obliteration. World War II is eulogized as history's most titanic struggle between freedom, democracy, and totalitarianism, fascism. Each claimed history on its side. The Germans, however conscripted, believed in the rightness of a thousand-year Reich, despite their detestation of Nazism. And the Japanese despised white colonial rule in Asia, although theirs was as arrogantly cruel. The wars in Korea and Vietnam were more subjective than their predecessors, so-called brushfire wars, to promote or prevent the spread of Cold War ideologies and to skirt nuclear obliteration while simultaneously risking it. As a result, both wars were inconclusive, yet at the heart of each, the combatants fought for beliefs latently instilled in them or fiercely demanded of them. So, Iraq and Afghanistan. The grunts on the ground most likely cling to a tenacious faith that they have liberated the Iraqi and Afghani peoples from monstrous regimes and now defend against resurrections of them. At the very least, the soldiers hope their great personal risks are for the exalted principles that are claimed, that their leaders are literally keeping the faith with them. Yet every day, the Americans and their allies face equal tenacity by hardcore insurgent resistance determined to oust the invaders whom they regard as infidel imperialists, as pernicious as the earlier medieval Christian crusaders of the previous millennium. Soldiers have been lied to throughout history. They have always been coerced in one manner or another to commit and suffer humanity's most hideous acts, generally in the names of its most sanctified beliefs. That has not changed. The Americans who are fighting and dying in Iraq and Afghanistan are as deceived as to the underlying purposes of these dual wars as were their predecessors of wars immemorial, and the rewards for such guileless intrepidity are as always unequal and usually disproportionate to the fervid sacrifice for them. The only purpose for armies is the destruction of other human beings. Soldiering is big business, the first order of every empire, as it has been since ancient times. But soldiers are themselves little more than expendable pawns, readily discarded. Without soldiers, there would be no wars, no Caesars, no Napoleons, no Hitlers. Soldiers kill, rape, pillage, burn, and if they are unlucky, stupid, or badly led, they die. Support for the soldiers acts contrarily as a relentless goad that pushes troops into irreversible horror, at the same time the cheering war cries crush any who would conscientiously object. The soldiers feel compelled to carry out what they perceive as public mandate, and in the belief that any personal doubts would be met with disapproval, they do their duty at whatever cost. Yet the soldiers we are exhorted to uncritically support can be turned against us. Order to suppress dissent and round up political activists. In times like these, such repressive use of soldiers could have wide support. Quite a few people think dissent is improper once a war has started and refuse to believe it is more necessary than ever. Their point is that dissent succors an enemy and betrays American troops fighting the war. The war parties always attempt to capture patriotism as their own and portray dissent against their wars as sedition and disloyalty. But dissent is the true act of patriotism and a more sensible way to support the troops that dispatching them than dispatching them into horror. As realized by the Vietnam War, dissent is the only way to stop questionable wars. Dissenters are not responsible for the misuse of the lives of the soldiers. The people who start wars are. And that was, Do Dead Soldiers Have Souls? And I'd like to follow it up with something else I wrote, Recruiting Tomorrow's Dead. And, of course, the disclaimer still holds. The most shamelessly exploited minority in American society is its war dead. They died horribly and most of them unwillingly, but they are not left to rot in peace. Their molding, mutilated corpses are eloquently exhumed as spearheads for the next war, their deaths extolled to recruit new armies. A language of lies develops. The dead always died for their country, heroically and nobly, and all of them willingly made the publicly acclaimed final sacrifice. None raped, pillaged, or burned, or committed other than sanctioned murder or terrorism. None died because of simple bad luck or from their own stupidity or that of their commanders or from callous or asinine battle strategies. None died from accidental shelling or bombing by their own side. Friendly fire. All of them were killed facing the enemy, not running away. Their deaths are glorified as justifications for the wars that killed them. Nations are haunted by their war dead. Monuments and memorials are built in every city and somewhere near the center of every town. The war dead assume a purity in death most would have found difficult to attain in life. The official piety is that the cultural lifeblood is sustained by their deaths rather than drained, and only by sacrificing themselves in the same manner will the living gain a similar historical legitimacy. Service to the state is always a possibility to the young, and death in its service is presented as either an ideal or an unavoidable necessity. Families of the dead who should protest the slaughter of their young are instead willing accomplices in the demand that warfare is the only acceptable response to an unruly world. Those who resist that specious reasoning are compared to the heroic dead as unworthy cowards and traitors, implicitly responsible for their deaths. War would end if the dead could return, Stanley Baldwin said. But the irony of war deaths exploited as coercion for others to murder and die is lost in the thunder of voices calling for vengeance and righteous war. War survivors are used as shabbily as the dead. They are contained within government-sponsored veterans organizations that rubber-stamp their approval on everything military. They are given parades and empty honors. The honor of their war experiences is shielded from public view, gold-plated in boilerplate and pageantry, yet they are undeniably representatives of humanity's dark side that civilization attempts to disregard or abstract, even while perpetuating it through them. War is blood, carnage, and death, which is so obvious a fact we often ignore it in our preoccupation with the rationales, strategies, weapons, and machines of war. Each generation seems to think it should not be outdone by its predecessors. It must leave its bloody mark on history, no matter how absurd or pointless. Every generation has been incapable or unwilling to arrest the pattern of terror and suffering each inflicts on itself, and our own risks world holocaust because of a compulsive insistence that our era, which is noteworthy only because we live in it, be no less dramatic than the histories we imitate. Albert Schweitzer warned in 1924 that the suicide of civilization was in progress because humanity has lost, quote, the consciousness that every man is an object of concern because he is man, unquote, and predicted that, again a quote, the advance of fully developed inhumanity was only a matter of time. We have talked for decades with ever-increasing light-mindedness about war and conquest, as if these were merely operations on a chessboard, Schweitzer wrote, asking how else that might be possible than, as a result of a tone of mind which no longer pictured to itself the fate of individuals, but thought of them only as figures or objects belonging to the material world. Half a century later, philosopher Donald Wells offered another explanation. The problem of war and conquest and the diminished value of human life was not due to a vague tone of mind, but the demand of government authority over the masses. Wells wrote, "If it is presumed at the outset that life of the state transcends that of the individual in value, indeed that the state is more important than all the citizens, then the fact of human death, on even a cosmic scale, will prove irrelevant as an argument against war." Inhumanity is exclusively human. History seldom mentions compassion or the consciousness of every human being as an object of concern, as Schweitzer wrote, as vital ingredients to the structure of civilization. Humanity's history is of wars. The most fierce and acquisitive sweep away the gentle and least avaricious. It was that way when our hairy ancestors thrust pointed sticks into each other. It is that way now, when the weapons of our industry are able to reduce continents to radioactive ash in minutes. The only real significance of the eternal conflicts of our species is the epic flow of blood, the slaughter of millions at each turn of history's gory pages, for reasons as brief as their lives. The names of the multitudes are lost. Only their numbers are marked, aggregates of killers and killed. Our mental evolution of the past 10,000 years has not eradicated the savagery or the terror of our most primitive ancestors. We continue to regard every other human and, by extension, other cultures, nations, religions, and races as our blood enemies. We continue to war or think of war as our right to dominate or destroy whoever is weaker, different, or in the way. We refuse to think of ourselves as parts of the same macro family or to understand the rarity or privilege of life. Instead, we make war more ardently than love. War gives our lives a transcendent vitality that daily living and its squalid defeats squeeze out of us. We feel that we are a vital part of great events, that our normally diminished lives serve an important purpose at a watershed moment, and we are never so united, so able to collectively surmount tremendous obstacles as when we make war against each other. We make excuses for warfare and accept it as a consequence of living. We seldom think of war as our invention. We treat it instead as a natural phenomenon, an earthquake, a flood, or volcano. We feed its insatiable thirst for blood with the best blood stock we produce. Until recently, the highest honors a nation or people could bestow were upon the men who draped themselves in the blood of others. Life's heroes have always been the men of death. As with most other effects of rapacious technology, warfare has advanced far beyond nature's strictures of weather or geography. The world's militaries, even the poorest from the most obscure nation, are able to make war any time, any place. State-of-the-art weapons float around the world, sold by arms merchants to anyone with money, credit, or good prospects. The industrial nations are arms bazaars, producing and marketing exotic weapon systems, vicariously enraptured by the increased carnage rockets and jet fighter bombers make of tribal-level squabbles. Perhaps abstract engagement in war is made possible by outlandish weapons designed in the manner of video games is verification of the popularity of reality as image, devoid of involvement. This de facto decadence might be related to the hallucinatory dread of nuclear obliteration, which has been almost too large a horror to bear for more than half a century. It seems inconceivable that humanity has made itself capable of its own extinction, and that by our own will we can disappear from history as absolutely as dinosaurs and dodo birds. Most folks refuse to think we could be so foolish. Yet they suspect our leaders have few qualms or sufficient fears, urged instead to the possibility of the unthinkable by prospects of opportunity. In such a world, reality hurts. We turn away as we would turn from a glare of sunlight. We submerge into banality to mute our angst. Genesis might be a warning. Instead of a myth of instant birth, it is a prophecy of megadeath. Perhaps we are still in the Garden of Eden, which is a metaphor for life. Evil might not be sex after all, or knowledge, but humanity's reckless ferocity that leads irresistibly toward plucking the ripe fruit of speciesside. War has advanced civilization as brutally as it has destroyed civilizations. Humanity is as accustomed to warfare as breathing and fornicating. We are a killing species. We rule Earth because our ancestors were clever, ruthless, and well-organized predators, and we have always butchered our own as readily as any other creature. We kill individually, which is murder, or we organize murder and name it war. We have throughout history honored the killers among us, and as we have become more settled and civilized, the laurels inevitably transferred from the stealthy hunters of animals to the slayers of human beings. All of our great civilizations and empires have been structured on the expenditure of human blood, the conquest and often decimation of tribes, cities, or nations, unlucky to be along the march of more militant, ambitious societies. War has affected civilization tremendously, but its effect upon those who suffer firsthand is given little consideration. Wars determine the reaction and consequent effect upon a society, and recovery is often a long, slow process. Those with personal involvement in a war are not accorded the same respect for their own process of recovery. Their private horrors and nightmares of war are dealt with impatiently and with scorn at possible psychological or physical disabilities, although collectively these sorts of disruptions and discontinuities are accepted as part of historical occurrence. The ambiguity of history might be encompassed in a phrase often used by Oliver Cromwell and others, "Pray for peace, prepare for war." Earth bristles with preparation. Yet a grim irony of this helter-skelter era is that we have reduced human participation in warfare, with an exception of possibly dying in appalling numbers. The invention of the harpoon gun and the exploding harpoon decimated the whales. The chainsaw has cut down the world's forests. By also inventing such weapons as the machine gun and hydrogen bomb, we nearly match our reckless despoilation of the home planet by abetting our own extinction. We have perfected war, refined it to an instrument of digital logic that no longer depends upon human rationale or justification. No philosophy or psychology, only strategy and provocation. Although armies might seem superfluous, they are useful for performing traditional fratricide, short of provoking megadeath. Dead soldiers are Christ-like in a sense. They die as surrogates for the rest of us. Unrestricted warfare in the last century significantly enlarged soldiers' always shadowy and disavowed parallel role as surrogate executioners. Looking at history through only the bloody prism of war is to miss much of the best of it and distorts it. Yet war shapes nations and individuals. Much of what each claims as heritage and honor is bequeathed by war. Waging war is a nation's most serious business. Robert E. Lee said it was probably fortunate war is so terrible, otherwise we might grow to love it. He did not foresee its possibilities as video entertainment. Smart missiles and bombs breaking down doors and falling through industrial chimneys. High-tech stuff in which sky warriors anonymously and indiscriminately, always hotly denied, murder strangers from the stratosphere. Most significant to the human psyche is that nearly a century of air warfare, powered aviation, is now 107 years old. This year has made the very sky that envelops the Earth the most dangerous threat to existence. A people will generally support a war once it is initiated, if for no other reason than they feel there is not much else they can do. That support is considered essential for conducting a war to its end in victory or defeat. In this era of the supposed common person, the focus of support is upon the average soldier, sailor, and airman, airwoman, who are not responsible for the wars they fight in but make possible. Bellicose war fever is whipped up to discourage questions of a war's purpose or cost, and to disguise the contradiction that supporting a soldier's warlike duty is a sure way of killing him or her. There is no good war and no bad peace, Benjamin Franklin said, but peace is also distinguished as a period between wars, a time to bury the dead, lick wounds, produce more and newer weapons, sow newer crops of human fodder to continue the genocides of their fathers. The questions of how to end warfare are ancient but never as popular as promoting it. The very few who raise the issue of abolishing war have been imprisoned, exiled, or executed through the centuries. At the very least, they are ostracized. Pacifism exudes an odor of weakness and appeasement, and pacifists are accused of being agents or dupes of an enemy. Pacifists are themselves in conflict. The central, most agonizing question is whether some principles are worth the risk of annihilation. Human life and possibly all organic existence is conceivably so rare in the universe that its loss is a result of dispute over abstract principles peculiar to a point in time would be more intolerable than the loss of those principles, which, human in origin, would just as surely evaporate in a holocaust. What difference does it make to the dead, Gandhi asked, whether the mad destruction is wrought under the name of totalitarianism or the holy names of liberty and democracy? Solutions to warfare have been ambiguous, insipid, and often ridiculous. Most pacifists agree that the only end to warfare will be a world state of some form, but one-world theories range from a loose federation of states, not unlike the United Nations, with the exception that its laws would be binding, to naked utopias and otherworldly Edens, or more ominously, Orwellian or Huxleyan nightmares of rigid authority and mind control, as well as perpetual war. Most solutions acknowledge the necessity of alternatives to warfare to engage its immense energies. William James suggested in 1914, the year World War I began, that there ought to be a, quote, moral equivalent to warfare, unquote. And although his idea that society exhibit the pomp and circumstance of a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta was rather silly, but not out of context with his pompous era, he also thought that, so long as the anti-militarists propose no substitute, no moral equivalent to war, the duties, penalties, and sanctions pictured in the utopias they paint are all too weak and tame to touch the military-minded. And that was William James. That is exactly the point. Militarism rules the planet. Military values are taught at every level of education and are incorporated in the root systems of societal values. Militarism is the antithesis of liberty and democracy, and its justice is based on obedience and servitude. The economies of most nations are poured into war machines that posture as defensive instruments, and world leaders blackmail their populations with terror, force them to surrender their lives and their children's futures, their wealth and liberties if they possess either, to the gross appetites and deadly illusions of military power. Nightmares of doom are disguised as dream worlds of prosperity. Armageddon is the place for the last battle at the end of the world. Almost all religions and myths prophesize a final conflict or cataclysm that will terminate human life, and our history has propelled us to the savage frontier of our most primitive fears. Military castes have been as irresponsible as priests in exhorting doom. They speak of themselves as guardians of peace, but prepare the methods for final combat, which is, after all, the shrine of their profession. War is to a man what childbirth is to a woman, Benito Mussolini was fond of saying. Putting an end to warfare will not end human conflict or greed, but war should be put aside as a toy of our youth. The ancient assumption that war weeds out the weak, unfit, and unlucky to ensure strength in future generations has been disproved by the enormous and indiscriminately devastating wars of the 20th century. A general who commanded the largest armies in history and who, as President of the United States, warned the world of the sinister and possibly obliterative consequences of the military-industrial mafia, his original inclusion of Congress was dropped. Dwight D. Eisenhower once said that, quote, "People want peace so much that one of these days government had better get out of the way and give it to them," unquote. History's dark glare shines on an earth too fragile for the titanic clashes of its past. Humanity, however, responds quicker to hatred and opportunity than to peace for its own sake, and never are these traits more represented than through a war's victors arguing over spoils of a defeated enemy. Civilizations have profited immensely from wars, and warfare has progressed civilizations' expanse and technologies. Yet war has also turned out the lights of civilization. Humanity has been set back centuries by its predilection for war, long periods of decline and retrogression, generations denied opportunities of learning and rebuilding, interminable cycles of darkness. Human antipathy does not go away easily or for very long. Old hatreds scab over only briefly and soon re-erupt. Someone somewhere covets something possessed by a neighbor, land, wealth, power. An insurgency plans an assault or ambush. Terrorists target innocents and guilty deliberately. A newly established nuclear power readies to flex it on an old enemy. Big war stuff trickles down from defunct Cold War arsenals into the grubby little hands of school children who arm themselves in the manner of gunfighters or gangsters. The United States commemorates its war dead on Memorial Day, which is at the end of May. It would be the proper occasion to pierce the illusions and deceptions and remember that the hollow dead would bitterly protest being used to kill others, and to take note of something written by Boris Vann: "The day nobody comes back from a war, it will be because war has at last been properly organized." The monument to the Vietnam War in Washington, D.C. is what a war memorial should be, a measure of its cost. The wall of names of Americans killed in Vietnam is a tribute to them from those who fought beside them and survived. A second wall should be set alongside, containing the names of all Viet Cong and North Vietnamese soldiers who died in the war, and both walls surrounded by a wall listing the names of every Vietnamese, Cambodian, and Laotian, man, woman, and child, who were not combatants but were killed because they were in the water the killer fish swam in, to paraphrase Mao's famous metaphor that the people were the sea to be fought over. Perhaps a special monument might be erected with the names of the murdered dead of My Lai by Americans and Wei by North Vietnamese, or Haditha in Iraq in another later war, to serve as a warning that the only enemy is the malevolence we humans feel toward each other. "With them in hell," wrote Wilfred Owen, regarded the best poet of World War I, and perhaps the best war poet ever, killed a week before the armistice, "the sorrowful dark of hell, whose world is but the trembling of a flare, and heaven but as the highway for a shell." And that was something I wrote, "Recruiting Tomorrow's Dead," a tribute to Memorial Day, and the wish that maybe someday there will never be any memorial days, at least for the dead of war, or that there be any war for there to be dead. Either way, if we continue war, we as a species will soon be dead ourselves as a result. That is probably a guarantee. And this has been Michael McCusker. Happy Memorial Day. I'll probably be before this microphone a week from now if the sky doesn't fall, a truck doesn't hit me, or we don't finally blow up the world within this next week in honor of Memorial Day. My name is Michael McCusker.